It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier, Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós Bolívar. That's 5 hours south from Cartagena in the García Márquez heartland of Colombia's Caribbean region. And this is episode 358 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you to all of you who tuned in to 357 when we're talking about the mapping of Colombia's ancient trails. So nice to be able to catch up 1 year exactly later with Gabriel Torres to see how his project and the desire, his plan, you know, came into fruition with the help of Tetractis in Grenoble, the French NGO. And so nice to have Gwen Prevost on the show as well from France, telling us what needed to be done and what, of course, is already in place in Colombia. This week's very special guest is Amy Booth, and she's a freelance writer based in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And she'll be talking about the landmark ruling regarding abortion in that country and what this means, you know, in the wider circumstances in South America. We'll play a couple of clips from that show now here before handing over to Emily Hart with the newscast this week. And then we'll be back with Amy Booth in segment three. And next week's show, 359, we've got CEO and director of Chiron Life Sciences, the medicinal cannabis company here in Colombia. It's Alvaro Torres, you'll remember from last year. But we've got a member of his board, a new member of the board of his company, board of directors, on the show too. You might remember him as being the Minister for Finance under the government of President Santos. That's Juan Carlos Echeverri. So quite a big name for us here on the Columbia Calling podcast. Anyway, I'll play a couple of clips. You'll be left in the capable hands of Emily Hart and then over to our conversation with Amy Booth. Thank you again for all of you listening. And of course, please consider backing us on the Patreon campaign. Just go patreon.com Columbia Calling. Thank you again and keep listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of January 11th, 2021. The scandal in Colombia's police force rumbles on after evidence emerged in December of the vast scale of corruption in the institution, as well as the systematic failure to investigate. Colombia's police force was shaken by evidence of alliances between police and both the Clan del Golfo and Mexican Sinaloa cartels. The police chief has now resigned. General Oscar Ateortúa was replaced by the National Police's former citizen security chief, General Jorge Luis Vargas, amid a wide-reaching purge of personnel. Figures show that 2020 was the most dangerous year for social leaders since 2011. 310 social leaders were murdered last year, and at least 375 people were killed amid 90 massacres. 2021 has gotten off to an equally violent start in Colombia, with political violence and massacres already perpetrated across the country. In Antioquia, on New Year's Eve, a former FARC guerrilla who had been taking part in Colombia's peace process was assassinated. Yolanda Zavala and her sister Reina were killed during a celebration, while another former combatant, Duván Arles Galíndez, was killed 2 days later. Since the signing of peace agreements between the FARC and Colombia's government, 251 reintegrating former combatants have been assassinated. Sunday the 10th of January saw the killing of three people in Betania, also in Antioquia, reportedly by the Clan del Golfo, who are the largest criminal group in Colombia. Reports of this massacre came in only hours after three people were killed in a similar incident in Caquetá, which also injured seven. The killing of human rights defenders and community leaders also continues, with the murder of Gerardo León in Meta and Diego Betancourt in Casanare. Both were members of the National Teachers Union. Authorities have, however, announced the capture on the 7th of January of Jesus Ramos Machado, alias Voluntario, the supposed leader of the Clan del Golfo group in the west of Colombia. Violence between the armed gangs themselves also continues, with severe consequences for those caught in the middle. The UN released an alert on the 6th of January about the humanitarian situation in Chocó, where at least 500 people, mostly from indigenous communities, are trapped by an armed group operating in the area. Despite the emergency having broken in October, the national government has yet to investigate and state forces have not accessed the territory to secure the zone. Additionally, in the north of Cauca, a confrontation between gangs in Puerto Tejada on the 7th of January left 7 people injured and 1 dead after a grenade was launched in a residential area. In coronavirus news, the second wave has arrived, with new cases at around 18,000 per day, a figure higher than that of the first wave. Around 120,000 people are currently infected, and more than 45,000 have now died of the virus, of a 50 million person population. The second surge is depleting medical supplies and space in intensive care units, many of which are well above 80% capacity. To tackle the second wave, local measures are being rolled out across the country with curfews, lockdown and bans on selling alcohol. However, Vice President Marta Lucia Ramirez has reiterated this morning that a national lockdown, again, is unthinkable and insists on the continuation of economic reactivation. Duque and the health minister have promised to begin the vaccination campaign in February. They have also announced that they will not be vaccinating the Venezuelan refugee population, who number in the hundreds of thousands. Only Venezuelans with dual nationality or formal migratory status will have access to the vaccine. Duque's announcement was met with immediate criticism on the grounds of xenophobia and crass populism, but also because academics have made it clear that excluding this part of the population makes no sense from a medical perspective. That was the week's newscast. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the third segment of the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 358. And as I mentioned previously, my very special guest this week is freelance journalist Amy Booth, who's on the line to us from Buenos Aires in Argentina. And I actually think she might be the first person based in Argentina that we've had on the podcast, even 358 episodes in. But we're going to be picking up quite a serious topic this week. We need to talk about, the details I'll leave to Amy, but as I understand it, the legalization of abortion in Argentina. And of course, we'll take it from an Argentine perspective through Amy. She's obviously been reporting on this for The Guardian, and she's written for Vice News and The Lancet and other outlets. But we'll take it from her perspective and then maybe sort of transfer it to Latin America as a whole and indeed Colombia. So we put it into context. So, Amy, welcome on the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Nice to be here.
No, it's a real pleasure because it's a real pleasure to have someone down there in Argentina and willing to talk about this, well, I would say, landmark decision. I obviously haven't been down in Argentina for a long time, and I remember when the first vote went through, and you know, then the idea was to get it to the Senate, and I thought, oh, will it get through the Senate? So just give us a bit of a background on what's going on regarding the legalization of abortion in Argentina.
Sure. So what has been voted on is that elective abortion, so abortion for any reason, will be legal for during the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. Previously, women were only allowed to have abortions in cases of rape or in cases of danger to the mother's life or health. Mother or gestating person, because this is a law that contemplates trans men and non-binary people as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive, massive expansion in abortion rights, because the Catholic Church has traditionally had a very strong influence here. And, you know, for them, life begins at conception. And so it's a really polemic issue in a country that otherwise has been pretty progressive. I mean, Argentina has some quite progressive trans rights legislation, for instance. Like, they recently implemented a trans labor quota, and they recently not so recently, legalized same-sex marriage. So we've had stuff like that for a while, but abortion was really tricky because there's just a huge segment of the population who say that, like, if you have an abortion even so early on that it's pretty much just a cluster of cells, to them that's a human life, and if you kill it then that's like murdering someone.
Mm-hmm.
But despite that, sort of the voice of like public health and feminism and women getting to choose over their own bodies has won out this time.
Oh wow. And of course this ruling that was, I mean, the historic ruling, we saw the images in the press and on the TV, the 29th of December, it came through and we saw people out protesting, but I assume there were people out protesting against the ruling. I mean, because the Catholic Church and this feeling is very strong.
So that's an interesting one. There were people who were there protesting against the legalization, but what basically this had caused such high tensions that there was actually like a massive like police riot fence set up, not just all the way across Congress Square, but for several blocks around it to stop the two sides from clashing, because there have been like, most of the ones that I've heard of have been violent attacks by pro-lifers on pro-choicers. I actually don't love the term pro-life. The abortion campaigners here would rather call them anti-rights. But anyway, so they'd set up this huge fence. There was a space of about 100 meters between the two of them, and there were police all over the place. They really, really didn't want the two sides mixing, so it was a little hard to see what was going on there. But I walked past it on the Monday night, because there were actually people in the streets two nights on the run. The first night people were sort of setting up and preparing, and then the next night was the vigil. Mm-hmm. But I walked past the first night, and they'd set up screens for like four blocks going down Avenida Entre Rios, and there was almost no one. It was very empty. The other point that has often been made is that this was more like a reactionary campaign, as in it wasn't people who set out to defend this right always and forever, but it more came in response to them realizing that there was a realistic chance that this would pass. But the people I spoke to who oppose abortion the night of the vote, because I went round the other side after the news came out, and they were saying things like, yeah, to us, this is the death penalty for the most innocent, is what one woman said to me. And she was sort of saying, why are we allowing children in the womb to be killed, in her words, when like we don't even have that for rapists? Another guy was essentially saying that he thinks it's like a political smokescreen, and that the politicians were doing it to appease supporters, because a lot of people haven't been that happy with how the pandemic has been handled here. But yeah, really, I think a lot of the opposition to abortion is about wanting to continue to police women's bodies, especially poor women's bodies, and basically to keep us in a position of domesticity where we're deprived of agency.
Hmm. Well, and of course, I think that's truly fascinating that the fence is put up all around. I can imagine it actually just off there. I guess the Casa Rosada, is it? Just off all of that area that they had it cordoned off, and then around the obelisk there where people traditionally congregate.
So it was like outside Congress, and then they'd sort of going down Avenida de Mayo, that was on the side of the pro-choice side, and then like all of the streets were blocked for about three or four blocks either way.
Incredible, isn't it? Incredible how, you know, well, obviously this is an incredibly emotional subject for so many people. And what do you feel were the key moments that pushed this vote over, pushed it through, so that it was passed for this landmark ruling?
So, as you mentioned correctly before, this is the second time that Argentina's government has formally debated legalizing abortion. The first time was in 2018 during Macri's government. And Argentina has a two-house system with deputies and then the Senate. And last time it passed the deputies, but it didn't make it through the Senate. What's happened since then is that there's been an election and a far more left-wing government took power, and so the Senate shifted to the left sort of in reflection of that as well. And I think that meant that this time the numbers were there. Another factor is that this time it was Alberto Fernandez, the president himself, who put the bill forward. And so it kind of had that it had that sanction from the highest levels of government that maybe it didn't really have last time, because, you know, Macri was saying more like, you know, my opinions and my opinions, but we should at least allow it to be debated, which is not exactly pushing it forward in the same way that Alberto has.
Okay. That's very interesting, of course, that the president should involve himself. And I just, so I put this into a whole different, I guess, onto a different platform living here in Colombia. And of course, I would say it's higher than 70%, the sort of strong Catholic and evangelical Christian pro-life belief, let's say. But I like to put it into a more philosophical and perhaps political bracket as well, is that we have some progressive politicians here in Colombia, and in the last election, for the first time ever, the runner-up was, you know, a properly left-wing politician, and he won more than 7 million votes, and that's unheard of in Colombia, where the left wing or progressive wing is you know, stigmatized by the conflict. But of course, I think that even progressives in Colombia would be very wary of addressing an issue such as abortion, so as not to completely alienate any potential floating voters or center-based voters, or maybe just right of center, because our conservative parties are further right here, even further right than right. And so I think that even our progressive politicians would be very careful about addressing an issue such as abortion. Now, I would like to put into Argentina's context, if I'm thinking out loud in this way, you know, you're talking about you mentioned this political divisions, the smoke screens. Is there any way that we can draw into this fervor and desire by new generations to really close the door on the authoritarian regimes and ultra-conservative regimes of the past? You know, when we talk about the dictatorships, the Galtieri, Videla, and prior to that, is that something that's related to this, where people, you've got a younger generation saying, listen, we've got a break from this, this is the new Argentina?
There's a couple of things that's worth pointing out there. So, I mean, for instance, groups such as Amnesty International have been saying that the right to abortion, they've been describing it as a death of democracy, essentially sort of saying that we can't really live in a fully democratic society until women have the right to make such a fundamental decision. And then you have to bear in mind that in Argentina, sort of the figure of like maternity was super important during the dictatorships as well, because we had so many cases of like young, pregnant, disappeared women. Like sometimes they would give birth before they were disappeared, which often meant, you know, being killed and then thrown out of a helicopter into the River Plate. And then like those babies would be adopted by families that were sympathetic to the dictatorship. And so there's been this big process of people occasionally being able to find out that they are actually, you know, their parents are not their real parents, and that their parents were people who had disappeared under this. So I think, and then, sorry, the other way in which maternity is sort of linked with democracy and the dictatorships is like the mothers of Plaza de Mayo, the abuelas of Plaza de Mayo, who were these sort of like often working class women activists who basically marched around Plaza de Mayo like every Thursday, even in the face of tremendous, violent, dangerous dictatorial repression, to demand that their children get brought back alive. So that's one way in which sort of the notion of like motherhood and choice and democracy are sort of bound together in the popular conscience here. A far more recent but arguably even more relevant factor is the Ni Una Menos movement, which is the, you know, it translates into English as not one fewer or not one woman fewer. And it essentially means no more sexist killings. And it was started after the murder of a young woman by her boyfriend. At the time, she was pregnant. Interestingly, she personally was opposed to abortion. And so at first, like, there was a kind of tension there between the abortion campaign and the anti-violence against women campaign, because they were saying, like, do we really want to sort of join this demand for abortion when it's a campaign in the name of someone who didn't want that? But they ultimately sort of came to see that not allowing abortion is another form of patriarchal violence, is another way of not allowing women choice and freedom and liberty over their own bodies. But I think sort of that has triggered a massive wave of feminist activism and scholarship as well. This isn't just people in the streets. This is feminist lawyers. This is feminist sociologists. This is feminist scholars of political sciences and political theory that's really helped to bring the conversation forward a lot.
It's interesting. And when it, I think politically we need to look at something. The Congress and the Senate here, I just need to ask, and I don't know if you know off the top of your head, what is the division between male and female senators and Congress people? What is it? Is it? I assume it's largely tipped towards men, but because I always stand up thinking in Latin America, it tends to be old men, old white guys making a decision for everybody, including, you know, regarding women's rights. So I don't know. What do you know about this?
I don't know the exact division in terms of how many are women and how many are men in the different houses, but that's definitely been quite an important sort of figure in the debate. Like, we've definitely had, as you said, some sort of old men who've been making some extremely like unpalatable arguments. I remember in 2018, like we looked at this in one of my classes on my master's, and they showed a video of a guy who was arguing that abortion had to be illegal because Argentina doesn't have enough population. It needs to populate its territory. And it just made it really clear that there are still people who literally still think that women are baby machines, that like we're just incubators. We aren't humans in our own rights.
So, yeah, definitely. Yeah, the baby machines. Of course, this is a belief that runs pretty strongly through most of the region. And I know that you've done work in other parts of Latin America. So if we take Argentina as, well, of course, as well, but if we take Argentina as forward-thinking, progressive country in this respect, and then we go north somewhat, let's just say, let's take a different culture almost entirely. In Bolivia, what are we looking at?
So Bolivia looks a lot at what's going on in Argentina because there's a massive, massive Bolivian diaspora here. And honestly, it's really, really stoking the debate. Like, I'm in a few sort of feminist groups on social media in Bolivia, and you're like, there are a lot of Bolivian sort of young feminists who really see why we need to have legal abortion. But you still see a lot of a lot of fairly unpleasant arguments along the lines of it's her fault for not keeping her legs closed, and like, you can't say that the man and the woman have equal rights when everyone knows that the man can just leave and the woman can't. She's the one that needs to take responsibility. And yeah, a lot of people who are just saying things like, you want the right to kill, why should you have the right to kill? That's a baby in there. And what I find quite striking about this is that, I mean, my personal sort of position is that we know, like, the best evidence that we have is that a fetus at 14 weeks, because we're talking about 14 weeks, we're not talking about aborting a fetus the day before it's born. At 14 weeks, it's about the size of a lemon. Like, the vast majority of studies believe it can't feel pain, like it can't really think. I don't understand why, other than because of this religious notion that life begins at conception, you would think that that fetus that is still completely dependent on its mother's body would have more rights than her.
And so I'm thinking, you know, and I'm hearing this, obviously the Bolivia thing, it must be very similar. Well, that those attitudes of, you know, why didn't she keep her legs closed? She has to care for the baby because... you know, she's the one who got pregnant. It wasn't the work of the man. There's no equality, because can't you just see the difference between men and women? There's a huge similarity between that and Colombia there. That is what I'm seeing and hearing. And I wouldn't have been able to make that comparison without you having explained a little bit more. And so thank you for that. Because when I was looking into, obviously, the issue here in Colombia, and so as of 2020, there are only three circumstances under which abortion isn't a crime. And so it's there the same. The danger to the life and the health of the mother, the existence of a life-threatening fetal malformation, and the third one, where if the child is a result of rape, incest, the pregnancy is a result of rape, incest, or non-consensual artificial insemination. So I guess, you know, that's the same as most other Latin American countries in this respect. I don't know widely about it. I mean, I'm taking into perspective Colombia and its Catholic basis. And of course, we've had very conservative governments. Colombia, I would say, overall is a conservative country. Even, you know, we talk about liberals and conservatives. The liberals tend to be quite conservative as well. And so, you know, there's no real separation of the church and state in this respect. When you hear me talking like this, was there ever dialogue similar to this in Argentina, or it's always been more forward thinking? Is there any way, do you think, when, you know, you make your comparisons, Argentina, Bolivia, and now on to Colombia, that there could be some sort of a snowball effect?
I think that even in 2018, when it didn't pass, the debate was really, really long. The debate was really, really profound. So we had speakers on both sides of the debate who were philosophers, biologists, bioethicists, lawyers, medics. We had a real broad spectrum of people giving their perspectives. And I think it really helped clarify the arguments in the minds of a lot of people. And what we found was that, for instance, there were a lot of women who kind of came round to think, well, maybe I personally wouldn't do it, or I don't think it's right for myself, but I don't feel like it should be banned for everyone else because everyone has their own circumstances. Mm-hmm. I also think that we made quite a lot of leeway in terms of discussing abortion as a public health issue, because that's how the campaign has presented it. It's a question of, this is not primarily about morals. It's also about the fact that at least 3,000 women have died in Argentina as a result of unsafe abortion since the dictatorship ended. something like 30,000 have ended up in hospital, and they get like really heartbreaking consequences. Like women can be left infertile, they can almost bleed to death, they can have severe kidney infections. And so on the one hand, there's obviously this fact that abortion happens either way. Like, you can't stop it. You can't physically have the state accompanying every single pregnant woman, making sure she doesn't abort. So it's going to happen. If you say you're against legalizing it, the abortions are still going to happen. We have like 500,000 abortions a year in Argentina. It's like one for every two live births or more. Like, it's really, really common. What you're saying is that you want women to go through terror and fear and danger because you don't think it's right. And I think sort of clarifying that perspective has really helped to bring the debate forward. And that, and the fact that obviously those complications that you described, that I described, are far more complicated and expensive for the public healthcare system to deal with than just giving a woman like misoprostol and mifepristone or doing the manual aspiration, both of which are pretty straightforward, cheap interventions that don't even necessarily require her to be in hospital overnight.
Those figures you mentioned, you know, like one for every two, I mean, it's like, that's a huge percentage, a huge percentage. And then I suppose some will be going overseas to try and do this, but there must be, all of them must have been illegal. These very dangerous, as you say, as they always say, sort of backstreet abortion clinics running, you know, flying beneath the radar of the law and putting the mother's life at risk, the woman's life at risk in almost every situation. I mean, absolutely terrifying to think of those numbers. Now, I think if we talk to you as a journalist on this one, when you're out there and you're, you know, doing the, making the questions and interviews in the street, do you get accused of not being objective in this argument? Do you get other people saying, oh, you're the press, you're all left wing, you're all this, you're all that? Is there anything that's like sort of like a risk to your person?
I mean, like, Argentina is a very polarized society and the press reflects that. So you get it from both sides. Like, there have been issues with, like, especially at kind of the anti-quarantine marches, the anti-mask marches. They've occasionally got pretty aggressive with the left-wing press, but then also, like, there's plenty of right-wing press that the left isn't really a fan of either. I mean, I recently did some field reporting where, like, we showed up and we were told that, like, the last journalists to show up at that particular place had been chased off site. I haven't had so much of a problem with that, to be honest. And I think that reflects the fact that, like, this is a debate that is already fairly widely installed in society. It's not like I'm talking about something that no one else is talking about or that no one wants to talk about. Just going back to what you were saying about sort of the numbers and the figures and stuff, I think it's interesting to highlight the role of misoprostol pills in this, because nowadays women who have the means often abort using misoprostol pills, and that's something that they quite often do at home on their own or maybe with the help of a sympathetic friend or relative. So as I said, like, a lot of, like, mifepristone and misoprostol pills are sort of one of the favored ways of doing abortions, and, like, in theory, they should be quite safe. Like, it's not like you're doing surgery.
Okay.
And so there's been, like, a gynecologist I was interviewing for a story recently said that the fact that now we have misoprostol in Argentina means that we don't see as many women who are aborting via horrendous methods, such as, like, sticking, I don't know, a catheter or, like, a head of parsley, like, up her vagina and trying to perforate, like, the uterine lining or whatever. which is the kind of thing that's like really unsanitary, really dangerous, really likely to cause severe problems. And so like that means that abortion pills have been really quite liberating here. But the fact that, for instance, even though there are cases of legal abortion here until I think 2019, don't quote me on that, but until pretty recently, you couldn't actually get misoprostol for obstetric use in Argentina. The only brand that existed was for its other use, which is for like gastric problems. Mm-hmm. And you still can't get mifepristone here. So,
okay, now, huge steps forward, let's say, huge steps forward. And I always worry because, you know, the each election, especially in Colombia, seems to flip back and forth between parties, or at least it happened for a long time. Is there any risk, or I guess the risk does exist, but, you know, another party gets in the next election, or the Congress gets packed with politicians no longer favorable to the current administration, can they reverse this ruling that was made on the 29th of December?
So a comparison that another interviewee made recently was the United States, where she was sort of saying that if there are people who really, really want to oppose abortion, like they will constantly find ways of trying to fight it. Like what we think is quite likely to happen immediately after this ruling is that there will be some kind of legal challenge claiming that it's unconstitutional, probably claiming that it violates the right to life or something, or that it violates the right to the health of the fetus. I don't think they could just overturn it like that. I think it would need to be debated, and I think sort of in a year or two, once we start seeing things like a reduction in maternal deaths, a reduction in maternal morbidity, it should become pretty clear that this is a good thing. Because another thing that I'm not sure I've mentioned yet is the extent to which this disproportionately affects poor women and women who live in rural areas. I know someone who had a legal abortion quite recently because of a risky pregnancy, and it went, you know, they were able to get the drugs that they needed pretty quickly. And I mean, it's always stressful having to have an abortion. No woman wants to abort, even if she supports the right to do it. Like, it would be ideal to not have unwanted pregnancies. But, the point was that she was able to get what she needed without too much hassle. Whereas if you can't pay for like a medic to do it under the table, or if you can't afford misoprostol pills, or if you live in an area where pretty much the entire medical establishment is against it, then sometimes even in the cases of where it's currently legal, women have to resort to backstreet abortions. And it's disproportionately likely to be poor women, women living in very marginal conditions, who end up going through this, like middle class women and upper class women who live in like central Buenos Aires are far more likely to be able to find sympathetic doctors to get misoprostol and to be able to have a relatively complication-free experience. That's not to say that there aren't. Obviously, they still have a lot of issues, but...
Well, I think that you're on point there, definitely. And I think that that's something that would transfer directly to Colombia when we talk about the, let's say, the peripheral areas of Bogota or Medellin, and of course, rural areas within the country where perhaps, you know, healthcare is almost non-existent. That's a problem that we have out here. I think I can't speak for Argentina, but out here in rural Colombia, you know, you can be in places where people have to travel hours and hours and hours for even the most basic medical attention. So I think that's something that would need to be investigated at length, probably has been investigated at length here in Colombia. I wondered, from your perspective and from what I might have said as we wind this down, and I'm so grateful for your insights and your, you know, sharing unselfishly all of your experiences here. But I, you know, you've heard what I said, the three instances in Colombia in which abortion isn't a crime. How do you feel? I mean, it's you know, we've got a long way to go, and you know this topic a lot. How do you feel? You know, Colombia, again, conservative country, strongly Catholic, a healthy, let's say, percentage of evangelical Christians, all in opposition to a legalization, even up to 14 weeks of abortion. What would you say? Is this going to take us a long time? Are we looking? I mean, I know you can't answer this, but knowing the subject and knowing Latin America, I mean, how do you feel when you look north to somewhere like Colombia? Or if you liken us to Bolivia in this respect?
I think there are sort of two prongs to this, one of which is that sometimes countries can slightly expand abortion access and kind of go bit by bit. And the other is to do with like better sexual education and better contraceptive access. So in 2017, Bolivia tried to somewhat expand abortion access. If I remember correctly, it was going to be for women who were students or had full-time caring responsibilities, and it was going to be to 8 weeks or something. So, like, that's obviously still a pretty short time frame, but they were just sort of starting to go, like, as a political theorist, sort of looking at that, you think they're trying to find other marginal cases in the public conscience where you might be able to have sympathy for a woman not wanting to have a baby. Because we tend to do that, right? It's sort of, we don't tend to talk about fighting for abortion rights in terms of the well-off professional middle-class woman who simply doesn't want to have another child because she already has two. We talk about the rape victim. We talk about the destitute woman who's addicted to drugs. So, I mean, that ended up getting struck down because of unrelated protests that led to the whole penal code project being thrown out. But that was kind of an interesting case study. Something else, that in Argentina, the slogan has always been like sexual education in order to decide anticonceptivos, contraceptives to not abort, and abortion not to die. So the point there is that sort of this isn't about us wanting to abort because we want to be able to go out and like get wasted and have risky sex on a Saturday night and then pop misoprostol pills as if they were Smarties. This is about the fact that if it comes to sort of an unwanted pregnancy, despite the fact that we already knew how to take care of ourselves, because it happens, we all know it happens, that we're not left to choose between like unwanted motherhood or being criminalized. So I think there's a lot to be done in terms of teaching children about like their rights to their own bodies, about the importance of like having people respect their boundaries, about the fact that contraception is normal and healthy and should be used, because obviously the Catholic Church has had a huge role in trying to dissuade people from using contraception as well. So that, and then also sort of an improved understanding of feminist theory is really important as well, because like all that feminism is really trying to say is that like women and men, we're both humans, we're both equal, we deserve equal rights and opportunities. And, you know, there are all kinds of different ways of saying this, but sort of it shouldn't be that difficult to understand why prohibiting abortion is profoundly sexist, it's misogynist, it's something that can only really affect women and other gender identities who are able to get pregnant. It can never affect a cis man. And I just think that sort of as awareness of these issues grows, so too does the demand for abortion.
I think a lot of my listeners as well will appreciate what you've been able to inform us here. And of course, we'll try and apply this and this knowledge to watching what happens in Colombia and see how maybe progressive politicians try and start to move towards, let's say, opening the debate a little bit more or just chipping away.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. 2 points that I try and make as briefly as possible, because I know you're trying to wrap up. But one of them is that sort of if you're in a society that accepts abortion in cases of rape, you essentially have a society that says that the problem is not that the woman had sex, it's whether or not she wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of changes. I mean, obviously, I think that it should be a no-brainer that abortion should be legal in terms of in cases of rape as well as all other cases. But I think it's really interesting how, you know, it's to them, it's kind of a question of, oh, well, she didn't want to. You know, the problem is when she wanted it. And the other question is that sort of people think that we're fighting for this right because we're fighting because we want to abort. And when you look at cases such as the famous case of Belén in Argentina, who spent about 2.5 years of her life in prison because she had a miscarriage. She didn't even know she was pregnant. She went to hospital with abdominal pain. And yet, like, it was reported to the authorities, which it shouldn't have been. But anyway, it was reported to the authorities as an abortion. And she was put in prison for 2.5 years for a miscarriage. And what we're not saying is, if this happens, we're all going to go out and do this just because we can. We're saying that if it's not allowed to happen, you get stuff like that happening. Yeah. And that's an atrocity.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, criminal sentences for something of this nature. Just listen, let me take this moment to say thank you so much, Amy Booth, a freelance journalist in Argentina, who's taken her time to talk about this this topic with us here on the Columbia Calling podcast. Check out her writing at amybooth.writes.com. That's her website. Of course, she's on Twitter as well. You can find her, you know, very easily if you wish to communicate with her or get get further information about these issues. Amy, thank you so much for your time and for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Great speaking to you.
And it's been a real pleasure indeed to have Amy Booth here. Check out amybooth.writes.com. I think a topic of great debate, and of course, how can we perhaps open the dialogue, I think, here in Colombia a little bit, just a little bit. We're dealing with all sorts of different issues here. And of course, one of the most topical debates that is going on is regarding the FARC guerrillas around the forced abortions that were taking place within their rank and file for female members of the guerrilla group. And this, of course, comes to the fore all the time in arguments, in the street, in Congress, in the press, and so on. So interesting to think about and interesting to, consider when we are talking about a topic of this nature. But I'm winding down now for today. This is episode 358 of the Columbia Calling podcast. You asked for this topic to be discussed, so we delivered. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for getting in touch. I'm Richard McCall, signing off from Mompox, Bolivar, Colombia. I spoke to Amy Booth, and this has been Columbia Calling. Bye-bye.